You're with us for the morning show as we discuss the arrival of the Johnson & Johnson COVID vaccine. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now there are three vaccine supply lines nationwide, so the pace of shots into arms will likely accelerate rapidly in coming weeks. And the new J&J shot only requires one dose. But a recent Kaiser Family Foundation poll found about one in five adults is taking a wait-and-see approach to the vaccine before getting vaccinated. How much have you heard about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine? What questions do you have about it? It's 800-642-1234. Dr. William Hartman is an anesthesiologist at UW Health and an assistant professor at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He's principal investigator for the UW AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine trial. Dr. Hartman, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, the Johnson & Johnson newly approved vaccine, they had revealed data showing this vaccine, while highly productive, had a slightly lower efficacy rate than the first shots produced by Moderna and Pfizer. So can you clear this up for us? What are the concerns here?
Well, I don't know that there's any concerns necessarily. It's hard to compare the two vaccines, the mRNA vaccines, and the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, because they were tested at different times. Mm. So the mRNA vaccines were tested at a time where the variants weren't very prevalent, especially the variant in South Africa. The Johnson & Johnson vaccine was about 72% effective in the U.S., but then in the worldwide trial, it was lower, around 66%, likely because of the effect of that South African variant in there. And so all of these vaccines are going to have a slightly lower efficacy against that particular variant. At least that's what's been seen so far. And so it's difficult to compare the efficacy one, you know, apples to apples.
It's not apples to apples. Okay.
Correct. I think that what we have to look at, though, is the end result. That being that the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is just as effective as the EUA vaccines that are currently approved in terms of preventing
emergency correct. Youth authorization. Go ahead.
Especially in preventing severe disease, hospitalizations, and death, which is really the goal of these vaccines, to prevent death from COVID-19.
So both the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines are mRNA vaccines. What does that mean?
So the mRNA vaccines, it's a slightly newer platform in which the vaccines really just contain the message or the note that gets passed to the cells to make the spike protein. They are a very simple vaccine that just has that mRNA message encoded in kind of a protective layer of lipids so that it can get into the cells.
And so the Johnson & Johnson injects viral DNA, not mRNA. How is that possible, and how does the J&J able to do that in a single dose?
So the J&J vaccine is an adenovirus vaccine, and so it uses the cell's machinery to turn on the system to make the spike protein. So the end result is the same as the mRNA vaccines. It just goes about it in a different way. And because of that slightly different platform and using the adenovirus kind of base, if you will, to make the vaccine, it allows the body to both prime and build that long-lasting immunity that we're hoping happens with these vaccines.
You know, this is one dose. Will that change your thinking or your approach on how we can deploy these vaccines?
Well, it's not just that it's a one-dose vaccine. It's also an inexpensive vaccine to make, and it's a very easy vaccine to store. It just requires normal refrigeration temperatures. And so it's a vaccine that can be deployed to every corner of our state, every corner of the country, and really reach all parts of the world because of its simplicity. And so I think that will change the way that the vaccines are deployed so that they can reach further parts of the state, make it easier for people to have access to a vaccine. And because it's only one shot, it makes a big difference in terms of if the state of Wisconsin, for instance, is getting 47,000 vaccines, that means 47,000 vaccinations. So we'll be able to ramp up the process of getting vaccines in people's arms.
Talking with Dr. Bill Hartman, anesthesiologist at UW Health and assistant professor at UW School of Medicine and Public Health, we're looking at the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, taking your questions about it. Have you been vaccinated? What do you want to know about the differences between vaccines? Do you have any questions about how they are administered or what they do? Join in at 800-642-1234. Lori has a question in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, Lori, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. One question that I cannot find the answer to is, how do the three COVID vaccines compare as preventing mild to moderate disease? I'm 62. I have high blood pressure. So I'm not eligible for the vaccine yet, but I'm very concerned about even getting a mild, moderate case of it. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Yeah, thank you, Lori. Go ahead, Dr. Hartman.
Sure. And so I think what we have to remember with vaccines is that the purpose of the vaccines is to prevent you from getting sick from a virus. It doesn't necessarily prevent you from contracting the virus, but they're very good at preventing you from getting sick from the virus. And at this point, when we talk about those efficacy rates, we're really talking about the efficacy in preventing the symptomatic COVID or the mild to moderate COVID that you're talking about. And so the efficacy of the mRNA vaccines, the Moderna and the Pfizer, is quite high, somewhere in that 94% to 95%. The efficacy, at least as far as we know with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine right now, is about 75%. So if you compare that to, say, the influenza vaccine, which is somewhere around 45% to 55% effective, these are all very, very effective vaccines in preventing you from getting symptomatic disease and even more so at preventing the hospitalizations and the death that can occur with COVID-19.
We're seeing the emergence of these highly contagious variants of the virus. What is the likelihood that these new the J&J vaccine will protect people from these other variants?
Well, I think that's something that is really ongoing. We're learning more about these variants as they arise. The South African variant in particular seems to be very well characterized at this point. And the vaccines are less effective against preventing symptomatic COVID from one of these variant forms from the South African variant form of COVID. And so while it's less effective, what we're doing is we're trying to figure out strategies to attack it. And so Moderna has created a booster shot that has a sequence for the variant, the South African variant COVID, so that you can attack that particular spike protein. Pfizer has asked the question, can we just boost the immune system with a third dose of their vaccine to overwhelm the variants with your own immunity? Johnson & Johnson is actually looking at an approach similar to that, where they would go to a two-shot instead of just a one-shot vaccine. But at this point, where we are in the U.S., they still feel the one-shot vaccine provides enough protection, and the other vaccines are doing the same regimens that they were approved as.
Okay, let's bring in Tracy now in Door County with a question. Hi, Tracy.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
My question is just, I'm curious to know what vaccine would be the best one for someone who has underlying autoimmune issues. Thank you, and I'll take the answer off the call.
Yeah, Tracy, thank you. So underlying autoimmune disease, what are your insights there on these vaccines?
So there's different types of autoimmune diseases, and so it's best to talk it over with your primary physician so that your particular case can be discussed. But in general, getting any one of the vaccines at this point will be beneficial, because even reduced immunity is better than no immunity. And so people with underlying autoimmune diseases aren't going to have the same robust response to these vaccines as a person without the autoimmune disease. But again, having some level of immunity is still better than having no immunity at all. So the recommendation is to get any one of these vaccines as they come available. But again, that's an important topic to bring up with your primary care physician so that your particular case can be discussed and all your questions can be answered.
We're talking with Dr. Bill Hartman of UW Health, fielding questions from you about the COVID vaccines, the arrival of the new Johnson & Johnson vaccine, what that means. What do you think about having a one-dose vaccine? Do you think you'd prefer one dose or two? Are you eligible to receive the vaccine? Can you book an appointment and where? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute with Dr. Hartman here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with Dr. Bill Hartman of UW Health. While the approval of three COVID vaccines is a glimmer of hope, the rollout of these vaccines so far has been slower than expected. We're discussing the intricacies of the new Johnson & Johnson vaccine, the status of clinical trials for future vaccines on the horizon, and Dr. Hartman is with us for 10 more minutes. Mark is joining us from Kimberly. Hi, Mark.
Hi. In the journal Science, there's a report of a nasal spray last one day, like 100% effective in the ferrets, the animals they were testing it in as far as stopping transmission. And it anchors to the nasal cells or even deeper in the lung with a cholesterol molecule. It's part of the thing. And it's completely non-toxic in their tests. They say it doesn't interact with the human cells. It interacts with the virus, and it interacts with the more inner part of the virus. And all of these variations, this adaptation, that mutation that the virus does to defeat us, is more in these spike proteins. But the inner part is more stable, and this they call it, you know, somebody called it a molecular mask.
Well, Mark, let's get Dr. Hartman's insights on the development of a nasal spray.
Well, I think in terms of the vaccines, they are looking at some non-injectable forms of vaccines, so that you know, there's people that are scared of the needle itself and the process of getting an injection. And so we have to figure out ways to get everybody who wants a vaccine, a vaccine. And so if we can come up with ways that don't require a needle, don't require an injection, that's obviously a real plus. I think what you're talking about, Mark, is something more of an antiviral treatment, however. So not necessarily a vaccine, but something that will attack the virus itself. And you have to remember, a year ago at this time, we didn't have any treatments at all. And so we've slowly been, not even slowly, it's been a pretty fast process, but figuring out ways to attack this virus on different levels.
Yeah.
Through, say, convalescent plasma or monoclonal antibodies, remdesivir. And so it's very exciting, actually, that some of these aerosols, like the one that you described, are coming to fruition so that we can have different ways to attack the virus. The best way to attack any of these viruses is to have a multimodal approach and to go about it by attacking at different levels so that the virus can't make mutations or variations to one particular treatment. And so I think that's an excellent point that you've brought up.
Yeah, Mark, thank you. Let's bring in Kathy now in Milwaukee with a question. Hi, Kathy, go ahead.
Hi, I've read that there have been 4 different medical studies of asymptomatic people so far, and all of them have found that even in asymptomatic people, there's lung damage. And at first they didn't know why, when there's no cough, and et cetera, but then they found that there's an acid that's naturally present in the lungs, in the lining. And when you have COVID, even asymptomatic, this acid multiplies and scars the lungs. And my question is, isn't it true, since the vaccine doesn't prevent you from getting the disease, only manages symptoms or keeps them, from becoming severe, wouldn't that lung damage still be happening in people who get the vaccine and then go on to get COVID?
Well, Kathy, I think that that's an excellent question. And I do think that the vaccines are going to help prevent some of these asymptomatic cases that we would see otherwise, because you're still getting a pretty reasonable amount of antibody, generated antibody, into your nasal mucosa to trap that virus and neutralize it before it ever even gets to the lungs. And we don't know what level that antibody is at this point. It's still being studied, but the presumption is that we'll be able to hopefully neutralize the virus before it can get to the lungs and cause any damage. These viruses, they have to be able to link up with the human cells to start to multiply and cause the damage that you see and that you're talking about. So if we can neutralize it by developing antibodies to the spike proteins which cause that anchoring to the cells, then certainly we hope to prevent some of these effects of the virus that like what you're talking about.
Let's spend a moment here on the AstraZeneca trial, which you're the principal investigator for UW School of Medicine Public Health. What is the status of this vaccine trial?
So this vaccine trial, the enrollment phase is completed in the United States. And so we've had about 31,000 to 32,000 participants nationwide. We're going through the process of collecting the data so that we know who developed COVID-19, symptomatic COVID-19 within our trial population, as well as the side effect profile to make sure that it's safe and effective. And we're putting that report together, and hopefully by the middle of this month, we'll have a very good idea of what the efficacy is here in the United States, the safety profile, and the goal, if all the numbers look promising, would be to submit for emergency use authorization sometime at the beginning of next month.
How long would the trial continue after the reporting stage, after the submission of the emergency use authorization?
So the trial itself actually goes on for 2 years.
Okay.
And the reason for that is so that we can follow these participants for a couple of reasons. Number one, we want to know how long the immunity lasts. And so how long do they have a robust antibody response? How long are these antibodies around? And so we'll bring these participants back every few months to measure their antibody level to see at what point do we have to give a booster shot if we need to give a booster shot. And then also some individuals have elected to get a vaccine booster on top of these, on top of the AstraZeneca vaccine. And so we want to know, does that give further robustness to their overall antibody response, and compare that to people who don't get the booster. And so there's a lot of ongoing investigation that's still very important, as we don't have all of the story written yet.
We're talking with Dr. Bill Hartman, who's an anesthesiologist, principal investigator on this COVID AstraZeneca vaccine trial at the UW. Bob is joining us from Clay Banks with a question. Hi, Bob. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thanks for the show. I was wondering how they exposed people in the trials to the virus.
So that's a very good question, because early when in the planning stages, they had discussed maybe even exposing people to the virus itself. But the virus is so prevalent, and it was so prevalent even in our own state, that we never had to come to that. So just by people going about and living as they normally would, doing all the things of social distancing, wearing a mask, washing their hands, avoiding large crowds, but just living like they normally would with either the vaccine or the placebo on board. And just by the natural nature of the virus, some people are going to catch it and other people are not. And so we didn't have to do any other exposure other than people living their lives as they normally would.
I want to land here on convalescent plasma. The federal government discontinued a research trial of convalescent plasma for COVID after a study found the treatment does not stop patients from getting sicker. What are you seeing? What did UW Health learn from these trials?
So I think the overall presumption on convalescent plasma right now, and the way that the FDA has rewritten their emergency use authorization for it, is that high titer early use of convalescent plasma, so within the first 2 days of a person being hospitalized with COVID-19, is still proving to be an effective treatment at neutralizing the virus. Much beyond that, or if you use lower titer antibody convalescent plasma, it's not going to be as effective, especially as patients move towards needing higher amounts of oxygen and go into the ICU or need to be ventilated. Convalescent plasma has not shown to be advantageous in those situations. And so early use, high titer convalescent plasma is still an effective therapy for COVID-19.
Dr. Hartman, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for having me.
Dr. Bill Hartman is an anesthesiologist at UW Health and an assistant professor at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.